Good afternoon, and welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. How can the health of our nation's population be declining versus other rich countries when we spend close to twice as much per person on health care? Can an economic recession be good for our population's health? Stick around and we'll give you the answers. Our phone number, 550-8422 in Anchorage, our outside number, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, our topic is factors that determine the health of a country's population. On Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, and our topic today is factors that determine the health of a country's population. Our phone numbers are familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8422, and our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And as you should know, you can email us during the program at line1@aprn.org. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Bezruschka. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington School of Public Health, and he's an authority on population health. Before I introduce him specifically, I want to just mention that next week's program will discuss factors that predict an increased risk of heart attack and, most importantly, what you can do to reduce your risk. We'll be speaking with Dr. Christopher Dyke of the Alaska Heart Institute about this. Dr. Bezruschka, it's just wonderful to see you again and to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Dr. Woodard.
You know, sometimes things come about, you learn new information, it really forces you to rethink what you were brought up to believe. I was brought up in a fairly strongly independent but Republican-leading household, and since I've met you and learned about the idea of population health, I've really began to rethink what government is all about, what health is all about, and hopefully we'll get some of that information and have some other people thinking about that today.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. How did I get into thinking about these ideas? It all started actually in medical school. That is, I went to Stanford Medical School in the early 70s, and I threw away most of my notes, but I kept some on a course called Society and Health. And on March 31st, 1971, there I wrote in my first lecture that in 1950-52, the United States had the lowest maternal mortality ratio of all countries in the world. I then wrote in a line below that, that by 1966, some 15 countries were doing better than we were. That is, our maternal mortality ratio, that is the number of women dying in childbirth within 42 days of childbirth, had declined, but it declined faster in other countries. Now, the only reason that I can say that now is I kept my notes. I certainly didn't remember it. It took me about another 15 years of working as a doctor to discover, in my own sense, that what had been in my lecture 15 years ago was true, namely our health compared to other countries was declining, and I didn't have a clue why. So that began my quest, actually. And it's kind of interesting that if you don't ask the right question, like why is our health compared to other nations declining, then the answers you come up with are kind of trivial.
I definitely want to come back, and I think during the program we'll answer or, again, ask the logical question, how are we doing now compared to the 50s and 60s? But I want to do that yet. Let's get some definitions. What do we mean by population health?
It's not a commonly used term in this country. I think of it as using mortality measures of health to get a sense of how healthy, how long lived a country is, and what are the factors that produce that. So it's the health of populations, and the populations can be a state such as Alaska, a country, you know, those entities.
And what results, what endpoints are we looking at? Longevity?
Well, that's one. That is born today, today's mortality rates, how long can you expect to live? Another one would be infant mortality. What proportion of infants die in their first year of life? And one that was published in a congressional report was, if you're 25 years of age, what are your chances of making it to retirement, age 65? That was in a U.S. government congressional report published a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. And in my introduction, I made the point that how much you spend on health care is not necessarily a positive, have a positive correlation with a population's health. So why don't we ferret out how that could be?
Well, the standard line, I think, to ask is, do you want health or health care? Now, as a doctor, as somebody who went to medical school, I assumed it was health care that produced health.
Right.
And it took me 15 or 20 years of practice and reflection to begin to ask the question, gee, you know, I don't think that's true. I don't think it is healthcare that produces health. So then I began to say, well, what else does? Now, I sort of came into these ideas on my own, and then I looked for other people to see whether or not there was any substance, any research to back up my idea that it wasn't healthcare that produced health. And I would say, just quote, for example, a book published by a group of scientists at the University of Michigan last year called Making Americans Healthier. And on page 3 or 4, they write that there is no evidence that health care has ever improved the health of whole populations, either today or in the past. Now, that's a very strong statement, mm-hmm. but it's backed up by all the evidence. You go to the Oxford Textbook of Public Health and then the chapter on medical care and public health, you know, they make the same kind of statement. However, if you don't have universal health care, then obviously it must be really important, because why are they denying it to such a large proportion of people in this country? It must be really good, and therefore we should have it. So the debate is about health care reform, not about health. I would offer we should be asking the question, well, how healthy are we and what do we need to do to become healthier?
That begs the question in my mind that if legislatures or the Congress, since that's where the debate is being held with the advice of others, but if they also understood this important difference between health and healthcare, would the debate be different?
I would hope so. But think about it. You know, you begin life outside the womb, usually in a medical setting. Mm-hmm. And there are doctors around. Mm-hmm. And then if anything happens after that, you're trundled off into the healthcare system, and you begin to think that this environment, the healthcare, the medical care environment, is something really, really important. So we begin life in this country around the presence of medical personnel, and at any sort of problem, we're steered back into that direction. You know, I've worked as an ER doctor for 30 years, and that's basically the complaint department. Everybody comes in there with a complaint. And so it must be healthcare that produces health. So you've got to ask the question, what's the evidence that that's true? Mm-hmm. Certainly in terms of spending money, you know, we spend half of the world's healthcare bill and we die younger than people in all the other rich countries. That's not debatable. That's mm-hmm. just the, you know, the hard, in fact, hard facts of vital statistics. So if it's not healthcare that's buying us health, what is? Mm-hmm. So if you ask the question, what produces health in society? It turns out to be the nature of caring and sharing relationships in that society, and especially those directed at early life. That's the critical piece of information that doesn't get transmitted to the – well, it needs to be transmitted very early in life because, you know, it's very hard to change beliefs or what we think in people my age or yours. So I asked this question, and when I go back to Seattle on Monday, I'll be in a grade 8 class in school. And a couple of years ago in that class, I was presenting some of these ideas, and the students were confused. So I said to them, how do you know, how do you come to believe that something is true? How do you know what's true or not? And there's long silence. And so instead of interrupting as I would usually do, I lived with the silence. Finally, boy raised his hands and he said, if our parents tell us when we're very young, if our friends and teachers say the same things, and if we've experienced it. Wow. Got to hear it early. It's got to be reinforced by people that are important to you, and you've got to experience it. So to try and experience that, what health care, medical care does and doesn't do, is very hard for most people. You have to look at it from the perspective of a doctor. You have to look at data. You also have to look at what happens when we stop working. and the whole world doesn't fall apart when doctors stop working. So that suggests that there may be other factors involved. It's a very tough issue.
You know, for me, having met you several years ago and thought about that and continuing to see this information come about and realize a lot of schools of public health, this is not unusual information. Even the government has reports on the importance of the difference between health and health care. I'm just thinking about people listening out there. I still haven't bought in. So one thing is clearly we spend more on health care, yet our country's health seems to be deteriorating. So another question is, what about other countries? Do they spend less on health care and have better health?
Okay, let's just go back. You said our health seems to be deteriorating. That's not true.
Okay.
In other words, the government always says every year Americans are living longer than the year before.
Right.
And okay. And so our health keeps on improving. It's a remarkable thing. There seems to be no end in sight. I think that's true.
All right.
But the question then becomes, well, what is the standard by which we should judge ourselves?
And why is it getting better?
And why is it getting better? That's a whole other difficult question.
Right.
But the standard should be, like, you know what a standard is, a reference is for a child's height or weight.
Right.
You know what a standard is for blood pressure or temperature.
Right. Right.
What should the standard for health outcomes be, as I've described them, namely mortality measures? And I think they should be those of the healthiest countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we should judge ourselves by, not whether we did better than last year.
Right.
And what happens, unfortunately, is that compared to other countries in the world, although our health is getting better, they're getting better faster.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because they're providing more health care services? No. As a matter of fact, if you look at, for example, 5-year survival rates for breast and prostate cancer, they're higher here than they are in the European countries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an artifact, okay, because we diagnose more cancers. So, of course, they diagnose them at an early age when they might not really be life-threatening. And so, of course, they're going to survive better. That's one perspective. Another one is, well, we just have better treatments. You might also say, well, why do we have so many of these diseases? We do seem to have more diseases than people in other countries, and they seem to kill us sooner. That's the key issue. That's part of the problem. You know, we have treatments for a lot of diseases, but the fact that we get more diseases should be a matter of concern.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying we get more diseases because?
Well, there's profit in diseases. We have a profit care system of delivering health care.
Right.
If we can make money off it, we will. Mm-hmm. And we do. We spend half of the world's pharmacy bill. We live in a pharmacracy. We have rule by drugs. The leading class of prescription drugs in this country are not the statins, which may have some benefits in saving lives, or the antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
We take more of those than any other prescription drug category. So we must be the happiest country in the world, right? Well, of course not. So we need to ask more fundamental questions about whether the money we're spending is just a very profitable business, or whether it actually produces the outcomes that we desire.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Steven Bezruschka. He's an authority on population health. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, you can give us a call up until just before 3 o'clock Anchorage time. Our phone number is 550-8422. Also, if toll-free number 1-888-478-8255. And you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at aprn.org. So health care, the amount of money we're spending on health care, is clearly different than the health of a population. And it doesn't matter how much we spend on health care. And in this country, we've gotten very good at spending money on health care. However, we're not getting our money's worth in health out of that. That's what you're telling me.
Yes, and one might ask the question, well, if all of health care can't be shown as to actually improve population health, Is there a subset? Is there a category within healthcare? Could we sort of limit the services to something that we know works? And the evidence there is pretty good. Countries or populations that focus on the delivery of primary healthcare services, the sort of things done by family doctors, by general internists and pediatricians, that those kind of basic services are the good part of healthcare. Countries that have a higher proportion of general practitioners, of primary care practitioners, of mid-levels. You know, you here in Alaska, you use a lot of those, nurse practitioners and physician assistants and various extenders. Countries that focus on those services have better health outcomes than countries that focus on specialist services. You know, you're sitting across from me right now, and if I were a gastroenterologist, I know you've got $3,000 sitting in your colon there, and all I've got to do is put my scope out there and fish it out, and guess what? Yep. 5 years later, it's back there again. Yeah. That's the wrong focus. Mm-hmm.
So if the amount of money we spend on healthcare, and I'm convinced, I think it makes lots of sense. The evidence seems pretty good to me. You've already hinted at what does help hint the social milieu, social factors. You want to flesh some of those out a little bit better for us?
So, you know, we are a social species, and we depend on face-to-face contact for very much information. We have studies showing that people without friends die younger. People who are sick who don't have friends don't get well as quickly. All of these factors, beginning with a study in Alameda County in 1979, was sort of the first study that looked at this very seriously. And of course, there are many more. So when does this social support matter most? Well, it turns out to matter most in early life. John Bowlby, a British psychiatrist, studied orphans after the Second World War, and he found that infants who were presented with a single pair of eyes from a caregiver for most of their first year of life had far fewer behavioral problems, had better health outcomes than infants that were presented with a variety of different eyes. So, you know, babies are born, they don't have very good eyesight. They can see contrast. Two most important black-white contrasts they need to see are the whites of our eyes and the sclerae, you know, the white sclerae and the darker center of the iris and the pupil. The other thing is the pigmented areola of the nipple of the breast, because that's sustenance. It turns out both are probably equally important. That is, the babies recognize that pair of eyes and a bond of secure attachment that Bowlby described happens, and it's not so if you have a variety of different eyes in front of the baby. So what are some policies that translate into secure attachment? Well, the key one is time. If a mother has no time to be with her infant, then there's no way that secure attachment can come about. You know, Carl Sandburg said, time is the coin of your life. Only you can decide how to spend that coin. Be careful lest others spend it for you. So what do we do in this country to see if once a baby is born, there is this time to have secure attachment? Well, United States, Liberia, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea are the only four countries without a paid maternity leave policy. You know, you just go across to Canada and you have essentially a year's paid maternity-paternity leave policy. You go to a country like Sweden, your leave is at full pay. Equally important to what happens after birth is what happens in the 9 months while you're a fetus, while you're in the womb. And if we think about it, that is the most sensitive period of our entire lives. You know, you and I started off life as a fertilized ovum. That ovum, our mother produced when she was in your maternal grandmother's womb. Okay, so your maternal grandmother has something to do with your health. It has to, because it was produced. Half of you was produced in your mm-hmm. maternal grandmother's mm-hmm. womb. Mm-hmm. That fertilized ovum then divides 42 times to produce a newborn. Okay, 42 cycles of cell division. After you're born, it divides another 5 times roughly to produce you. Well, those periods of cell division are incredibly sensitive to environmental and social and psychological and nutritional factors. those 42 cycles. Mm-hmm. So that's incredibly important. I just came back from this the 6th International Congress on the Developmental Origins of Health and Disease in Santiago, Chile. And it was all about these early life factors, you know, the first 9 months in the womb and then the first couple of years afterwards. And roughly half of our health as adults, half of our health now, has been determined, programmed by what happened in that period of time. So we need policies to give time to parents to spend with their newborns, and we need prenatal leave policies. Chile has a 6-week paid prenatal leave policy for working women. You have to take 6 weeks off if you're pregnant. Again, we have no policy in this country. So that's where the money should be spent, primary care and on policies to give time to the most critical part of the lifespan.
If we get a chance, I'd like to just mention how we know from new developments in genetics, even the mechanism by which some of these early influences occur. Let's take a call that we have. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I just have a comment. How can I say this? I am a more mature person than many. I grew up during World War II. I was blessed with healthy parents who were fussy about my care. However, there was no meat, no sugar, and no fat. Those were all rationed when I was a child. So we grew our own fresh vegetables. We didn't have gasoline because it was rationed, so we walked. We had exercise, we had a reasonably decent diet, and since I lived on the West Coast and there were lots of servicemen going back and forth, they offered us lots of inoculations, and my mother got us inoculated for anything that was available. I think it helped.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So it brings up the question, if I can perhaps paraphrase what you're saying, is that non-medical care issues such as exercise, diet, activity, and stress may be more important, you believe, also to health than the health care we receive.
Well, I haven't seen a doctor for heaven knows how long because as soon as I got on Medicare, they don't see me anymore.
Yeah,
but I think a lot of it was also when I was a small child, there was a depression on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ate less and we walked more again.
Right.
And I grew up with that. I still don't drink soda pop, but maybe 4 times a year because I don't like it. I never developed the habit. If I'm thirsty, I have water. Thank you very much. My mother instructed me that way. 1 quart of milk a day up until the time I left home, which was when I was 23.
Hmm. Mary, let me ask you a question, if I may, that I asked. I gave a course in Edmonds, Washington, to a whole bunch of retired folks, and they were all 60 to 90 years of age. And in the introduction, I asked them to say how much of their first year of life they spent with one or other parent. And I'd like to ask you that same question. How much were your parents there for you?
100% of the time, except when my dad was at work.
Okay. That was true about every one of the 30 students in my class.
Mm-hmm.
The parents were there for them.
Yeah.
And that is a critical thing. Mm-hmm. You know,
my dad was gone from 1942 to 1956 or so.
Right. But your mother was there.
Yeah.
Right.
There was a parent, and things were a little more strict then.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't snack.
Mm.
You know, I mean, yes, you can have a glass of milk when you come home from school. If you're still thirsty, have water. If you're still hungry, go out in the yard and pick a carrot.
I think you got a great upbringing.
I mean, you know, that was the way it was because things were tight, things were rationed, they weren't even available.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't tempted.
So it is kind of interesting, since you mentioned the Great Depression, that we have studies now confirming that health improved pretty remarkably, health as measured by these mortality rates, during the Great Depression. And actually, one of the factors that was important during the Depression was the amount of relief. That relief was the term used back then for welfare. the more relief you had in the 112 or so cities where this was studied, the better the improvements in this case, infant mortality. And there are other studies, too, that have been published on the same idea. Health improved an awful lot during the Depression.
Well, I, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, it was offered probably not necessarily for money at that time. You stood in a line and you got things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my folks didn't. My dad was lucky. He got a job right after college in 1930.
Mm-hmm.
He hoed weeds for Standard Oil.
Mm.
A college graduate, Diamond Hour.
Right.
But it was a job.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not insecure ever. Yeah, I mean, we were not rich, but, you know, there was never real scary, everybody's out of work and we're going to lose our home and everything, which was probably helpful.
Mary,
but
thank
my eating habits and my exercise habits almost were the first 10 or 12 years of my life. We didn't have lots of meat. We didn't have hardly any sugar, and fat was rationed, and you took spare bacon drippings back to the butcher so they could put it into making arms.
Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
We appreciate your information. Bye-bye. Early in life exposures set down, I mean, as we learn more and more about mechanisms in science, we learn that early mechanisms, what we do early in life sets up habits. Some of these are good habits, the exercise, what we eat, how we eat, whether we stay active. And that has a big impact on health, I think you would say.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to the doctor. I mean, it has benefits. You're right. You're making me think very specifically about what I say. The bottom line is a nation's healthcare is a group of people. It's not very dependent. In fact, maybe adversely affected by the whole issue of healthcare.
Yeah, you know, if suddenly I were to collapse here and have a cardiac arrest from you know, and go into ventricular fibrillation, I hope you'd use the AED or something like that on me to sort of see if you can revive me. You know, that's what I've done most of my life is provide these services in extremis to people, and that's really, really important. And people have to feel like they can access those services when they need them. But health is a heck of a lot more than disease care.
Okay. We're going to come back to that. We're going to take just a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And email us at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk with Dr. Stephen Bezruschka of the University of Washington School of Public Health. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic imaging equipment, radiologists, technologists, and clerical staff committed to breast cancer detection. Information online at provimaging.com. Primera, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescription, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign.
This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Bezruschka. He's a senior lecturer at the Department of Global Health, the University of Washington School of Public Health, and an authority on population health. If you have questions at all or comments, you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. You can call us directly here in Anchorage at 550-8422. And we have a toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 o'clock on Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be available. As we finished that last segment, it finally dawned on me another kind of corollary of this whole issue. As we spend more and more on healthcare, and remember, we're spending twice as much as everybody else in the world on healthcare, and yet our healthcare relative to everyone else is decreasing, there is another sneaky side effect, if there will, of our healthcare, and that is we're spending more and more and more of our gross national product, which leads to more and more social inequality, less and less options, less and less resources for all of us. So it's kind of a can get into one of these spirals if it's not too simplistic to say. So your comments?
Yeah. So we spend right now roughly a sixth of our total economy on healthcare services, about 16-17% of our gross national, of our very gross national product. I mean, it's huge. From 2000 to 2005, we seem to desire economic growth, the increase in the goods and services in our economy. From 2000 to 2005, one quarter of our total growth was taken up by the increase in healthcare services. Now, what did we get for that? You know, we didn't get any better health, as you point out. Our health Right. compared to other countries declined. So we're spending this enormous amount of money, and it's a big part of our growth, and it's taken up with hospital services and clinical services and tests and drugs and all that. It means we can't spend this money for other things. A big player in this is the healthcare insurance business. It is a business. It's a very profitable business. In 2005, the healthcare insurance company profits alone were over $100 billion. So we've got a total amount of expenditure in 2007 of roughly $2.6 trillion. And about a 20th of that went to just profits for healthcare insurance companies. I mean, that's why it makes it very hard in this discussion of healthcare reform to tamper with the insurance model because it's such a profitable industry. And furthermore, public opinion surveys for at least 20 years have shown that most Americans would prefer a single-payer option with universal coverage. The numbers expressing that vary from 50, 60, 70%, depending on the surveys.
And the majority of physicians I've seen say the same thing.
Yes. Yeah, that's not an option. That is not one of the options being considered today.
Right.
Now, why is that? Something our media has been very lax in reporting are all of the campaign contributions to Bacchus and all these various players in the healthcare reform business, pharmaceutical companies, all the insurance companies. And they say, oh, these contributions don't influence my policies or thinking. Oh, come on. Mm-hmm. So as long as we have such a huge industry, it creates all this wealth, and the wealth creates more inequalities. And the people who can't pay for healthcare services feel they're being denied. And so the studies over the last 30 years have shown that inequality is the key factor. Inequality in society, income inequality being usually what's measured, is the key factor driving the worse health status of the more unequal populations. There's now over 200 studies on this. And just published in the British Medical Journal last month was a meta-analysis, fancy term, for all the multi-level studies on income inequality and health. And they then calculated how many excess deaths occur to inequalities above a Gini coefficient of 0.3. Forget what that means other than the higher the number, the more unequal the society. And they calculated for the United States that roughly 880,000 deaths a year occur because our inequality is greater than the Gini of 0.3. Mm-hmm. That's one quarter of all deaths in this country. So if, in fact, this study is to be believed and it's consistent with the other 200 studies, once you calculate the population attributable mortality, one quarter of all deaths due to inequality, is that a price that's worth paying? Mm-hmm.
And as we become more and more unequal in income, which is also, I think, substantiated over the last 30, 40, 50 years in this country, particularly also relative to other countries, there are more and more social prices to pay for that, which also contribute to healthcare, drug abuse, premature birth, the to name a couple that come up to the top of my head,
right,
which drive our health care costs up.
Right, right, right. No, it's so there's no benefit.
Yeah.
You know, there's a book just that came out in England earlier in the year, The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better, by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. Mm-hmm. It has come out in December with an American edition published by Bloomsbury, and it basically lays out all the data for these ideas. And so, for example, we have the highest teen birth rates of all rich countries. And teen births are related to income inequality. We have the highest youth homicide rates. We have one of the worst educational outcomes. They, in this book, meticulously show the evidence for all of these statements backing this up. So you then say, well, so why are we such an unequal society? What good does it do us? Well, the economists traditionally used to say inequality is what drives us to work harder. Mm-hmm. That is, we work harder to try and get ahead and make more money to become rich. Well, at this point, in October, President Sarkozy of France released a report that he'd commissioned 2 years ago that asked the question, what should we be measuring to show that society is progressing? And it was authored by two Nobel Prize-winning economists, Joseph Stiglitz, Amartya Sen, and a French economist, Fattusi. And what they basically said, gross national product is a very poor thing. Economic growth is a very poor measure of what's good in society because, for example, you know, suppose a couple gets divorced. Then they each got to buy a separate house. They each got to buy separate appliances. The gross national product goes up. Is that a success or is that a failure? Think of the family mm-hmm. and breakup and all of that. So the report said we should be measuring other factors like the well-being of society, like its health compared to other societies, its happiness, if you will. You know, there's a whole group of people that believe we should be measuring gross national happiness like Bhutan does, mm-hmm. and that should be our goal in society. Mm-hmm. Certainly more economic growth, the evidence is, does not benefit anybody. Mm-hmm. And so there are these, part of the reason the world is the way it is because rich countries are growing quickly and there's a whole bunch of poor countries. Well, we're not growing now with the recession. And a whole bunch of poor countries that are falling behind. They're not catching up. Rich countries need to rein in their economies. And we have to find some mechanism of equitably sharing economic growth in the poorer countries. That's really the task at hand for the next few decades.
Yeah, and there's the task of just getting people to change their way of thinking about this. This is not the way I was brought up to think. It's not the way my parents, as bright as they were, would accept easily if I didn't keep talking to them about it. But, you know, it dawns on me also that we're losing – one way to try to get people to think about it is we're losing our competitive advantage because we're throwing so much into healthcare. I mean this is a little different. I mean we're not able to spend as much in research, science, technology, and education, for example, to keep us competitive. I mean there's a lot of reasons to think that we really need to rein in the healthcare costs, but that's not entirely the whole issue here. The whole issue is trying to be more equal as a society in there. But all of those will benefit from that. All of that will come back as a positive benefit if we were able to accept that way of thinking better.
Why do we need to compete? Why do we have to become more competitive? That's the whole neoliberal economic dogma that we need to sort of restructure society and make us more competitive.
Right.
Well, first of all, take a country like Sweden, which is one of the healthiest countries in the world. I mentioned some of its mm-hmm. policies. Sweden, by the way, its government spends more money on the first year of life than any subsequent year afterwards. In this country, we spend all our money on people over age 65. I mean, there's no health benefits to that. The money is all in early life. Sweden has as good economic growth or better than the United States. It's been insulated from a lot of the problems with the recession. The issues in this country come down to the lack of people to look at the available evidence and think critically, what's really best for me? What's best for my children? What's best for my community? What's best for our country? And what's best is not more economic growth. You know, growth for growth's sake is the ideology of the cancer cell. And I don't think that's what we should be pursuing.
We've got a couple of callers. They've been waiting. I want to take them. Tina, you're on line one.
Hi. I was going to talk about the good old days initially, but my mind has changed just from listening, from being on hold. I really appreciate what you're saying, and I think that it's criminal what is being done as far as advertising and advocating against health insurance for Americans. I'm a person who can't get health insurance. I'm self-employed, and I'm in a very small pool that isn't open and available. And plus, I have pre-existing conditions. And the whole idea of the inequality in healthcare and what's available, and how somehow the media is able to convince the people who most need the assistance that somehow or other it's evil and bad for them, I think it should be criminalized, as I said. But is there anything that can be done for so that people know what's real and what's not?
Well, I like the idea that all the people in Congress have to use the same health care system that we do. That was one of the better ideas that I saw come across in some email. Anyway, let me ask Dr. Bezrushka to respond.
It's kind of interesting. I was a medical student at the time that the Tuskegee study came to light. In 1972, it was discovered that we were withholding treatment for syphilis for African Americans in Tuskegee. And this brought such a huge sea change in the fact that to do any experimentation of any kind, you now have to go through this huge institutional review board policy. Now, the people that were not treating African Americans were whites and blacks, and we thought it was just okay to do that. Today, not having universal access to health care, although I've said it doesn't do much to produce health, could be seen as the same criminal intent of society not taking care of its people that the Tuskegee study could be. And we might see this in 50 years' time, and we will need to then have to do a health impact assessment statement for any kind of social policy, just like we have to do an environmental health impact assessment. Mm-hmm. Our thinking has changed from the way it was in the 1930s to when the Tuskegee study came out, and our thinking may very well change in the ensuing decades and say it is criminal, as Tina says, that people that need the services don't have access to them. Mm-hmm. The other thing that healthcare services do are for those people like Tina who have to pay out of pocket for them. You know, medical bankruptcies are one of the leading causes in this country, and that's just criminal too.
Yeah. I mean, the other point is that most other developed countries, it's unheard of. It doesn't happen.
Right.
It
does not.
It's not an issue. They can't understand that it happens in the United States.
Right.
Tina, thanks for your comments.
You're welcome.
Let's see. We got one more caller. Ian, you're on line one.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep. What can we do for you?
I grew up, I'm 23 years old. I just moved up to Alaska from Minnesota for a job, actually. And I grew up in a really healthy family. I consider myself a healthy person. My whole family helped raise me my whole childhood. It was great. But I am a type 1 diabetic. And in this world, you know, having just finished up college and getting a job and all this, healthcare and insurance really is the big concern for people my age. And I'm wondering, as the numbers of people that are being diagnosed with diabetes, both type 1 and 2 and other conditions like myself, what I have, what's the health insurance or the healthcare system going to look like? As these numbers are rising and we're, you know, contemplating this fundamental change in how we provide care for our citizens?
Well, type 1 diabetes is really an important condition for which we know how to monitor outcomes. We know how to sort of help you treat yourself, because that's really what you have to do. And that should be a no-brainer. So from an evidence-based medicine situation, there should be no question about, well, first of all, everybody should have access to health care when when they need it without question of payment. It makes no sense. You come from Minnesota, so Minnesota is one of the healthiest states in the whole country. And that's because many more of these caring and sharing factors that I described earlier are there, and you talked about growing up in a healthy family. That happens because of social policies and concerns at the state level in Minnesota that are beneficial for everybody there. So I wish I knew what to say about accessing health care in the situation the way it is now. But there should never be any consideration of not letting people who need health care get it.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of those situations where it's a slam dunk.
Absolutely.
And in fact, it's criminal not to be able to access the have access to the health care that's needed. And,
right.
And again, I think from my understanding of reading in Denmark and Switzerland, Germany, you get cared for if you got diabetes.
All the other rich countries. Well, no, they just have universal care for everybody.
Mm-hmm. But in particular, these chronic diseases are getting addressed. And here you have to struggle to get what you need.
Yeah, the onus is on you to sort of get the care that you think you might be able to pay for or have paid for, rather than having the system to take care of it.
In my introduction, again, I talked about that a recession might be good for our health. We need to at least address that more specifically. Help me understand that.
This is really a fascinating thing. Some studies were done, published in the 1920s, looking at the Roaring 90s and this period of big economic growth 120 years ago. And they seemed to find some links with worse health during that period compared to the period where the economy was kind of not doing so well. And these were published in statistical journals in the 1920s, and people said, this can't be true. Let's just, it just doesn't make any sense. So the idea got buried for a while. Then in the 1970s, more studies appeared suggesting that maybe, the economy booming was not so good for us. And finally, in 2000, this happens pretty often in science, things get reinvented. Christopher Room, an economist at the University of North Carolina, published his papers on what had been happening to the economy in the United States and found that mortality was pro-cyclical. And pro-cyclical means mortality goes up when the business cycle goes up. It goes down when the business cycle goes down. There's a background. Health keeps on improving, but the improvements are greater during times when the economy is not booming. So that's now been verified in many, many studies in rich countries. For poor countries, we can't say that that's true. But several studies are important. One is when you take all the 23 countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the 23 richest countries, they find the same relationship, namely the higher the unemployment rate, the better health improves. And that sounds really counterintuitive. But the improvements depend on the social system in place in the country. So in Sweden and those countries with a strong social safety net, the difference between the booms and busts, their impact on health is fairly small. But in the United States, where we're in the cafeteria society, you're on your own, the yo-yo society, then the differences between booms and busts are really big. About 1% unemployment change doubles mortality. Not double, sorry, I have to get the numbers right, but it increases mortality. So why might it be important? Why might health be better when there's really high unemployment? Well, remember earlier I talked about time. What do you do when you're unemployed? You have some time. There are actually studies looking at the unemployment rate among women in the United States when they conceive. And the higher the unemployment rate, the better the birth outcomes, the lower the incidence of low birth weight, the lower the infant mortality rate for those women. That means maybe they have more time. Motor vehicle crash deaths are at the lowest they've been since about 1956. They've just been plummeting recently. In Seattle, at our trauma center in the spring, I asked a guy who worked in the ICU, and he says, the census is way, way down. That's where they take care of all the trauma. Mm-hmm. People are just having less road rage or less in a hurry to get to their second or third job. And that's so stress. I'm not saying that everybody benefits from from a tanking economy, but overall, the averages work out so that it is better. We have coronary artery disease, deaths go down, stroke deaths go down, cancers stay about the same. That's stuff that's programmed much earlier in life, and that's not going to change much with the economy. So what that does is give us an opportunity to rethink, well, what's this economy for anyway? Are we to keep on the treadmill and work harder and harder, more and more jobs to try and make ends meet? Or should we sort of scale back, let the poorer countries catch up with us and be healthier in the process? Kind of win-win to me.
Yeah. All right. We have another caller, and we've got about 7 or 8 minutes. Julie, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. This is such an interesting program. I wanted to make a comment, two separate comments. One is that I lived for some years in Australia and was not a taxpaying Australian citizen, of course. But while there, I purchased health insurance from the Australian agency that made such insurance available to long-term foreign visitors. And I purchased health insurance there that was far better than my Alaska State employees' health insurance, which was pretty darn good. And it cost me, in 2002, it cost me $95 a month to have solid gold insurance coverage from the Australian agency. And I can't tell you how much I miss that now that I'm back in the States. But the main reason I wanted to call in was to point out that in this country, I constantly hear people saying that, oh, well, the poor are covered. All they have to do is go to the ER. Well, I'd like to just explain how awful that assumption is. I'm an attorney who's done some pro bono work, and I used to work at a disability law center. And when low-income people are forced to go to the ER, you know, their kid has an asthma attack or they get injured, it's true, the ER, such as Providence, has to treat them. But they then turn around, of course, and bill them, and the tremendously high bills are then turned over to a collection agency when these people, most of whom are the working poor, they have low-wage jobs, but they're working, or perhaps they're disabled. The accounts are turned over to collections agencies, which then get judgments. Once those judgments are on their credit reports, those low-income people are going to have a hell of a time ever getting a mortgage. Their permanent dividend checks are going to be seized, and in fact, it's even going to preclude them from getting some jobs because many employers will check credit reports when they're doing a background check. Now, unfortunately, the hospitals locally, including Providence, their PR people say, well, we'll always work out a plan with low-income people. But in fact, that's not true. I know from experience. So it's a terrible situation when low-income people who get injured or whose children get injured wind up having to go to the ER because they don't have health insurance. And then in addition to the trauma of the need for getting emergency treatment, they're then going to suffer terrible financial damage that's going to have long-term results. And when I lived in Australia, I was constantly asked about our healthcare system by my doctor, my Australian doctor. And when I would explain these things to him, all he could say is, what is the matter with you people, America?
Yeah.
That's all.
Well, yeah. All right. I think it's very, very important for those of us who have not been in that situation to really appreciate the reality of perhaps the unluckiness of being in that situation. However, I'd also point out that more and more and more of us, and inevitably it's going to keep getting bigger, can't afford health care, and we're going to be faced with similar problems with mortgages and so forth. So, Julie, thanks for your comments.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Dr. Brzezuska, do you have some comments?
Well, I thought that was interesting. She mentioned the permanent fund dividend being seized. And, you know, that's one of the things that sets Alaska apart from all the other states in that they have a bit of a non-means-tested welfare program for everybody. And that's, in a sense, what we need to have in this country. The kinds of policies that I think would free up the money that we need to fund the things that we think are important are just those that our leaders have proposed in the not-too-distant past. You know, in 1942, President Roosevelt proposed 100% tax on all incomes above $25,000. Now, that didn't pass. A 94% tax passed. So our tax rate in the mid-1940s, was 94% on above a certain minimum. Mm-hmm. You know, $25,000 in 42 works out to about $500,000 today. Most of us could live on that if we had mm-hmm. to. Why not bring back the kind of legislation that was proposed by a Democratic president Or how about what a Republican president proposed? In 1969, President Nixon proposed his family assistance plan that was a guaranteed income plan for all American families with children. It would be like the Alaska Permanent Fund. It would be a guaranteed income for everybody. And believe it or not, this was a Republican president. It passed the House of Representatives. It languished in the Senate. Nixon got embroiled in Watergate, and it was over. But I'm not talking about anything more revolutionary than what our elected presidents have proposed in the not-too-distant past. Take that money, and that's the coin that you use to provide the time you need to produce health in society.
And yet, what I constantly am hearing from opponents of health care change and our legislators is that it's going to cost too much. And if anything, it's going to cost us more not to do anything. And we all have to come to the realization we're going to have to get more revenue for the government to do the things we need to do. We're not – go ahead. That was a temper tantrum that came out unexpectedly there.
Or we decide to ration health care.
Uh-huh. Well, oh, really?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the key thing to do. No other rich country that provides universal health care does it without rationing.
Yep.
You can't just have, unlimited access to stuff that is, if anything, harmful.
But we ration it in this country. Everybody's right. We just ration it a different way. Right. You just don't have access to it because you can't afford it.
You know, I used to teach this course with a Croatian who immigrated to Norway and then he came to the United States. And, he said in Norway, everybody is in the same queue. And if you have a 6-month waiting time for your hip replacement, and if you were the prime minister, you'd have the same 6-month time.
Right.
I think the solutions for healthcare in this country are to take out or at least decrease or minimize the profit motive and to salary people in it rather than that. Because medicine done for profit is not good for health. Then we need to ask the question, what does produce health in society? Do we want health as a goal in this country? And if so, what do we need to do to change the policies that are going to produce it?
Mm-hmm. So as I see it, and is right now, we're beginning to do the due diligence. We're talking about it. We're trying to get people to talk and understand that there's a problem. There seems to be an acceptance that the healthcare situation is a problem. But it's going to take a long time to do the things we need to do is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and it starts by asking a few fundamental questions. You know, do you want health or health care?
Right.
And recognize that early life lasts a lifetime. And the two are kind of linked. You know, that the policies you put in place for early life will direct the health outcomes of this country. Mm-hmm. And, we have... We're coming up to the Healthy People 2010, the CDC report, in which we're not going to fall way behind, and we're soliciting ideas for 2020. I think we need to make health in comparison to other countries the priority we should aim for.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure, Dr. Mrzruszka, to have you again on the program. Let me ask all our listeners to send a copy of the program to anybody they know. They can refer their congressmen and senators to KSKA.org, and they can all listen to it. I think it would be good and helpful. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll return with Dr. Christopher Dyke of the Alaska Heart Institute, and we'll be discussing factors that predict an increased risk of heart attacks and what you can do to reduce your risk. Pat Yak is president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Speck, thankfully, engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.